Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
Back again with Rob D sitting in for Austin today. Rob, thanks for sitting in for Austin on his honeymoon. Man, it's always a pleasure having you on the podcast.
The pleasure is all mine, Brad, and Austin could get kicked off because he's too important now anyway.
Well, I'm excited about the guest today, Rob, because it's one of our gang, right? It's one of them that we interact with and banter with all the time. Jorge, before I introduce Jorge, I'm just going to bring him on. Jorge, thanks for coming on. Dude, I love you. I'm so glad to have you on the podcast finally. Rob, how exciting is this?
Oh, my God. This man is a legend and makes me laugh all day, every day. Love this dude.
What's up, Jorge?
What's going on?
You are a legend. So let's paint a picture here for the listeners because, Rob, what's going on here has to be orated to listeners that are not watching this. Jorge has a big, humongous cigar fatty. He's sitting in a looked like a somewhat of a reclined position, and he is tugging on that stogie like it's the last one in his pile.
Well, I was going to say he had a brown phallic shaped object in his mouth, you could say cigar. That's okay. But for everybody that doesn't know Jorge, he is always smoking a cigar, whether it be a giant one or a little one. Jorge is a connoisseur of cigars.
That's what retired people do.
Well, Jorge Trevino is a good friend and is a former Marine. No, you can't say former. He is Marine, served in the Marine Corps, and then is retired from the United States Border Patrol. And I don't want to dive too much into that because I want Jorge to tell his story. But from here on, he'll be referred to as the Iceman. He is, that's his nickname, right? Is that fair? Nickname in Border Patrol?
That is fair. Some agents know me as Iceman and don't know my real name.
Yeah, so they don't even know what they don't even know your name is Jorge. They just know Iceman. When you speak of Iceman, such a cool nickname. I've heard the story, but why don't you tell us how you got Iceman as a nickname?
So back in the day when I got out of the Border Patrol Academy, the FTO program that we have now did not exist. So you came back from the academy and boom, you went right out to the field. On my first day, I got sent to the checkpoint there in Laredo, Texas. And about 5.5 hours later, I had a Smith & Wesson 9mm to my head. And can I say the piece of shit? The piece of shit that had it was pulling on the trigger. After a couple of pulls and I saw that nothing happened, I turned around and I took him down or whatever. After handcuffing him, I looked at the gun and the bullet had gotten stuck on the slide, causing a what we refer to as a stovepipe. In the chaos, everybody ran out. The senior person at the checkpoint, I went up to him and I asked permission to smoke because I was a little, the pucker factor had gone up a little bit. And it's like, dude, if you have the presence of mind to ask for permission, like a good trainee, you got to have ice running through your veins. And from that point on, I was known as the Iceman.
Unbelievable.
Funny story though, when my son was born, we always would put the name and the size and the weight and the date and time of the birth of agents, kids. So when my son was born, they put Iceman had a little boy, 19 inches, you know, 11 whatever pounds, and they put him right from the bat. His name was Ice Cube.
Oh, that's awesome! I love that. Well, what you just described was an enormous boy.
I'd like to ask Jorge, mentally, this guy tries to kill you, right? Obviously, he pulls the trigger multiple times, and we're talking many years ago because you're hence retired and you were just out of training when that happened. What did you do mentally during that time to help you get through that?
Like in most law enforcement or first responders field, I went home and drank. And actually, one of my superiors suggested to go home and have a cold one, that I deserved it. Of course,
and that goes have
to,
a drink.
That goes to what Brad and I were just talking about with June being Men's Mental Health Month. Is that that's ingrained in us, and that's the stigma, and that's the things that the men should do, or what we're told they should do, is to, hey, you almost just died, but have a drink, or have a girlfriend, or have a, you know, whatever, cigarette, or whatever vice to do. And we're here, and we're on this podcast to try to change that stigma and that,
and suck that up. Thought process. Suck it up. Don't dare complain about anything.
Exactly.
Well, Jorge, I would love for you to kind of tell us your story. Iceman. Sorry, from henceforth, you'll be referred to as Iceman on this podcast. Iceman, take us on a little journey on the story of your life.
Well, I was born here in Brownsville, Texas. I'm the youngest of eight, born December 24th, 1966. I can't really complain about my upbringing. I had a great upbringing. Well, being the youngest, my brothers would always gang up on me and stuff, but that's pretty normal. Very active in sports during my school years. I enlisted in the Marine Corps right out of high school. I was in the infantry unit, and about 2 years into my enlistment, my gunnery sergeant suggested I should try to go into a marksmanship instructor school because I picked up shooting pretty good. So I went off to become a marksmanship instructor. Within that year, I ended up going into my 4 years were coming up, and I was thinking of getting out, and my first sergeant didn't want me to leave. And I was a little, I guess, upset because in those, I don't know if they do it the same way now, but in those times, you earn points by taking certain classes throughout your military time. If you scored a perfect score on the physical fitness test, you got so many points. If you shot expert with a pistol, you got so many points. If you shot expert with a rifle, you got so many points. So you started accumulating points. And I had the points for a promotion that at that time, I guess the other minorities were getting selected more than, and I never understood. I mean, I'm Hispanic and I'm a damn minority, but I got passed up several times, and I was kind of a little disgruntled, and I was looking to get out. And my first sergeant says, look, if I can get you into a sniper platoon, will you stay? But you got to commit to 4 more years. And I thought about it, and I'm like, you know what? That is pretty cool. I said, if you can guarantee me that I'll get in, I'll stay. He goes, I'll get you in, whether you pass or not, that's up to you, but I'll get you in. So sure enough, a few months later, I was off to Quantico, Virginia. That's where the Marine Corps Sniper Training Battalion was at. And I became a sniper. So before,
had you had any experience with, did you grow up with shooting guns? Did you grow up that way? Or is this a new skill that you're learning?
My dad let me shoot. He had an old 38 special. And I shot it once. And other than that, no, I didn't handle any other type of weapons.
So this must have been super fun for you.
It was, and that's why I kind of jumped at the opportunity, because I was like, well, when the hell am I going to do this again?
Just to let everybody know, every time that Jorge takes a pause, he's smoking that giant cigar.
That is awesome.
I don't know.
His house is on fire right now.
So before I keep up with that, during my whole life, different people, including mainly my mom, she would always tell me, you have a purpose to be on this earth. Don't waste it. And you have a purpose. And then other people tell me, dude, you're meant to be here for a reason, you know. And I never knew what that reason was until I went to Chateau, or I came out of Chateau, and I started focusing on me. But anyway, so I re-enlist for my second term in Marine Corps, and in January of 1991, I landed in Saudi Arabia, and we started making our way north to Kuwait. And for those youngins that don't know about Desert Storm, we liberated Kuwait from Iraq. Saddam Hussein had taken over the small country, mainly for the petroleum business. So anyway, the war happens. Eventually, the ground forces start making their way north to Baghdad. And my first brush with death was as a kid. Back in the day when you can throw all the kids in the back of a truck and take a half an hour trip without any problems. We were going to the beach, and my dad got cut off. He swerved. He went up the road. The tires cut onto the sand, and the truck overturned several times. All the kids, my brothers and sisters and nephews and so forth, everybody got ejected from the back, and the truck landed about a foot away from my head. So that was brush number one. Back to Baghdad. As we are entering Baghdad, we're clearing buildings, if you want to call them that, shacks, one by one, and we're expecting the Republican Guard, which Saddam claimed to be the baddest of the baddest in their military. And I got on my knees, and I was looking around a corner to make sure it was clear. And I felt like somebody had pushed my head, and a bullet hit the top of my helmet and ricocheted out my helmet into the wall next to me. The Marine behind me, Scott, he saw it, and he pushed me forward. And I'm like, what the fuck are you pushing me, fucker? And he goes, dude, you almost got shot in the head. And when I looked at my helmet later on, it didn't penetrate the helmet, but it made like a little groove where the bullet just ricocheted off. So that was number two. We went about our day. The Desert Storm War didn't last that long. I was in country for about 8 months, I believe, 8.5 months. And then we went back stateside. And then eventually I got out of the Marine Corps after my second deployment. Or my second enlistment, I'm sorry. And I came back to Brownsville. And of course, let me go back a little bit. And you know, as a young kid entering the Marine Corps, I drank as a teenager, but nothing crazy. Or at least I would say nothing crazy. I don't know. I probably did some crazy things. But when I got into the Marine Corps, it kind of went up a little bit more. Because now I didn't have mommy and daddy next to me. As a matter of fact, one of my sergeants, and this was, I guess you want to call it a tradition, because when I became a sergeant, I made sure that my platoon had a vending machine. They would buy old vending machines and fill them up with beer. And when I got to be a platoon sergeant, I made this deal. I said, look, everybody gives me so many dollars, and I would put that money towards beer, and I would make sure that the machine's always stocked. So that was the arrangement, and everything worked perfectly. I don't know if you guys, I don't think Rob would remember, but maybe Brad. But remember back in the 80s, in the late 80s, when all the generic crap came out?
Oh, yeah.
And there was just a white package and said bread. And then there was a white can and it said beer.
Beer.
And it tasted freaking nasty, but it was at the PX in, I want to say in 87 at the PX. It was $2.98 for a case.
That's what it was worth. That's what it was worth.
That's what it was $3 for a case. So
that, was it water or was it actually beer?
It was nasty beer, I guess. But, you know, a 19-year-old kid from South Texas, hey, beer's beer.
Beer is beer.
So,
Jorge just lit his cigar again because it went out because he was talking too much.
That was the torch blower you heard on the podcast.
So now I'm out of the Marine Corps. I come back to Brownsville after being in bigger cities during my Marine Corps time. I kind of didn't want to be here anymore. I reconnected with old friends from high school and of course the partying and the barbecuing at people's houses. Of course, drinking was always involved. And I tried to get in with Brownsville Police Department, Harlingen Police Department. I went up north to San Antonio to take the test for the San Antonio Police Department, and I fell in love with the city. I went back home. I packed my car full of whatever I could pack it with my stuff, and I moved to San Antonio. A good friend of mine and Marine Corps buddy was from San Antonio, and he had gotten out before I did. And he had always told me, hey, dude, whenever you're in town, you know, look me up and whatever. So I did. And I'm like, dude, I'm going to move up here. I don't know where to live. And him and his family, his wife and kids, graciously offered their house to me for for a while until I found my own place. So I took him up on it. And I moved to San Antonio. I found a job at a bank as a security guard. While I was waiting for the San Antonio Police Department test. Well, I never got into San Antonio PD. I tested for Austin. I tested for San Marcos. And San Marcos called me. And I had accepted the offer. But I had also tested for Border Patrol. And about 2 weeks before I was supposed to report to the San Marcos PD Academy, I got a letter from Border Patrol offering me a job. So I disregarded San Marcos and I went with Border Patrol. So my duty station with the Border Patrol, like I said, was in Laredo. I pretty much stayed there my whole career. I went to the academy. And became an agent. And like I already explained, on my first day at work, I almost got shot in the head. And like Rob was talking about, I was encouraged to go home, buy a 12-pack, go home and just drink the stress away or whatever. And then I didn't tell, well, now my ex-wife, but I didn't tell her anything because she was pregnant with my son at the time. And I didn't want to cause any stress or whatever that may complicate the pregnancy. So I didn't tell her anything until after my son was born. And even then, I kind of downplayed it a lot. I just told her I got into a little scuffle. But then the day came where I had to go to court. And she's like, well, what is the court about? You know, I want to go. I want to see. You know, I've never seen anything like this. And I try to talk her out of it, but you know, when a woman makes up her mind, there's no turning back. So she went to court and she heard the whole deal and she let me have it when we got home. She's like, why didn't you tell me? And oh my God, and you could have been killed and you would have missed the birth of our son. And you know, all these emotions came up. So the drinking, of course, at the time, I never saw drinking being a problem. I was a social drinker. I guess the culture in many first responder communities, whether it's fire or PD or whatever, it's pretty much the same. You get together off duty and you get families together and you cook out, but drinking is always involved. And drinking, I guess now that I'm retired, I can say it, but for quite a long time, management was aware and did not stop drinking on government property. We would drink at the station. We would have, so for example, when I was on midnights, we would get off at 8 a.m, go turn on the pit in the back. Whoever the lowest ranking agent was at night shift, we would send them to the store. We would get money. We would send them to the store and buy the meat and whatever. And of course, buy the by the beer or by, you know, whatever liquor that had to be drank.
You know, I do think that, I don't think the level of drinking has changed, but, you know, part of what you're saying definitely resonates with me because early in my career, I think we as a community got together more often. I don't think that happens now quite as much, but man, back in the, you know, the 20, 30 years ago, it was really common to have the group get together as a whole, families getting together, your loved ones. It wasn't just the officers or the firefighters getting, it was a family event. I think the drinking was the same, but I think the gathering together, looks much different today than what it used to be. That brings back some great memories for me as you're sitting here talking, because some of those gatherings back early on in my career, those were great memories.
And they are. I have a tremendous amount of memories, and you know, I have to say now, well, at least in Laredo, drinking is not allowed on government property. But it took an agent to get two DWIs going home from these. We call them pachangas, right? So that's Spanish for a coca, I guess. So we get out at mid, you know, at 8 a.m. By 9, 10 o'clock, we were already cooking the meat and whatever, and everybody was already drinking. But I personally would always treat my, regardless of what shift I was on, I was, you know, you work your 10-hour shift or 12-hour shift, whatever it is I was working. I would get out and stay up for a number of hours, and then I would go to sleep. If I was working day shift, right? You get out at 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the afternoon if you're working days, and then you go home and then you do stuff around the house, or you cook, or you put kids to bed, or you do homework with them and whatever, and then you go to sleep at night. And then you wake up in the morning and you do it. Well, I would, in my mind, that helped me to keep my sleeping pattern kind of similar. But then when I would have trouble sleeping, you know, whiskey would always help. So the drinking continued. I was a young agent. I was in my early 30s. And the drinking at the station turned into, hey, dude, I'll meet you at this bar, or I'll meet you at this place. And I started going to places without my wife or my son. And eventually, I fell into the trap, and I had an affair. My wife found out, and she packed her bags and left. So, like a good drunk, of course, it's never our fault. It's always something else or someone else, right? So I think around that time was when I started drinking more liquor than beer. I would sometimes get off early take my gun belt off, take my uniform shirt off, and I would stay with a green pants and a white or a green t-shirt. And we would call that the BP tuxedo. And I would go straight to a bar right after work. And like I said, I was drinking more whiskey at the time, but I was drinking it with Coke, and I would get these horrible freaking hangovers until an old man at the bar at about 4 p.m. He goes, "Hey, you know, I see you come here a lot." And I'm like, "Well, every time I come, you're here." I said, "Do you ever go home?" And we started a friendship, and it turns out he was a customs agent. And he was doing exactly the same thing I was doing, except he had an office. He was some type of supervisor for customs. So he had an office where he could change. And I didn't want to go through the hassle of packing clothes and changing in the station. I just would take off my shirt, take off my gun belt, and I would go with the rest. But anyway, then he suggested that I put water or just ice on the whiskey, and my hangovers would go away. So, of course, I put it to the test. And for the most part, yeah, I guess it did help quite a bit. And so that allowed me to drink even more, because I wasn't going to feel like crap the next day. So about a little over a year after, the divorce took a while. It probably was close to 2 years before it was finalized. And about 3 years after the whole thing, I met somebody else. And within a short time, we moved in together. She had a teenage son. And one day, she calls me frantically that her son had pushed her and tried to kick her and all this stuff. So I rush home. I was at work. I rush home. Call police. And this young man had already expressed that he wanted to get into law enforcement, whether it was Border Patrol or whether police department somewhere. And I knew that having a family violence charge on his background, he would not be able to get in. So I talked to him while the police officer was there, and I looked at, if you want to be in law enforcement, you cannot have a domestic violence charge. So you can either pack your shit and go with your grandma, and I'll pay for the bus ticket, or you can stay and deal with the consequences. So he chose to pack up and leave, and the police officer gave him a ride for me, so that there wouldn't be any other issues. And he left. So the following day, I go back to work. His mother, the woman that I'm living with, is now blaming me that her son got kicked out and that he wasn't there. I'm like, well, wait a minute. He's the one that beat your ass. Why aren't you mad at him? I said, I didn't tell him to beat you up. And he got upset because she took his phone away because he was skipping school. He wasn't passing a couple of classes, and he was talking to some girl that the mom had already told him not to talk to. So when she took the phone away, that's when he acted the way he did. And so anyway, we get into an argument, and she is very upset. She's not making any sense. I'm not too sure if she had been drinking or not, but she starts getting violent and throwing shit at me. And I'm trying everything I can to get out of the house, which I do. I might have moved her out of the way just for me to get out of the door. And I left. I didn't think anything of it. I went down the street to a buddy's house, another fellow agent. And of course, we drank. So a couple hours later, there's police officers at my buddy's house looking for me. I go out there and we're talking, and she was claiming a lot of things that did not happen. And next thing I know, I'm being handcuffed and getting thrown in the back of the police unit. I get booked because it was a domestic violence. I guess, I don't know, the law here in Texas, I think it's, you have to stay in the can for a couple of days. I get out of jail and I didn't want to go home. But I had to go to work because they had to serve me with papers. So, of course, once you get arrested, being arrested as a federal agent is frowned upon. From what I find out.
No doubt.
So they advise me of my rights to my union representation, and they take my gun and my badge, and I get placed on admin duties, right? So now I went home with a couple of my buddies so that I can have witnesses. I grab as many clothes and stuff that I needed as I could, and one of my buddies was letting me stay with him. She immediately regretted it. She went to the DA, and even at the threat of getting arrested for filing a false police report, she admitted that she lied about it. But the harm was already done, right? So eventually, the DA dropped the charges, but the Border Patrol still had, they left me on admin duty for 2.5 years.
Well, let me just interject there, Jorge. I mean, for people that don't know law enforcement and don't know the military and how things go, this is kind of normal. It's not that it happens to all of us, but for our non-first responders that are listening to this, I mean, look at how much trauma that he's gone up until that. He's been shot in the head nearly twice. He's conducting unhealthy behavior. And now, shockingly, he has domestic issues. Of course he's going to have domestic issues when his life at work is just dangerous and violent and he's had all this thing. And the only coping mechanism you have is drinking. And of course, when your life is that upside down and topsy-turvy, of course you're going to have a domestic incident or stuff that affects your job. So, I mean, does every cop or firefighter or EMS or anything like that deal with getting arrested and that kind of stuff? No, but our domestic life is definitely affected by this.
Absolutely.
And I mean, you know, I would say it is true, but the more unhealthy behavior you get into, and the more issues that arise because of that, you drink more, or at least I did.
Well, that's how you cope with it. That's how you've been taught to cope with it. When life goes to shit, just drink some more.
Yeah, right. Drink it away. It'll go away.
The No One Fights Alone podcast is excited to announce the launch of our new merchandise line. Now you can show your support for our mission by purchasing one of our hats, shirts, or hoodies. Our merchandise not only represents our brand and message, but also supports a great cause. A portion of all proceeds will go towards helping individuals and families affected by mental health. Wearing our merchandise not only spreads awareness for our podcast, but also serves as a reminder that no one has to fight alone. Join us in showing your support and spreading the message of hope and community by purchasing one of our No One Fights Alone items today from our website, nofapodcast.com, nofapodcast.com.
So eventually, after years and years, I get returned to the line. During the admin duty time, though, I'll point out that I only get paid my base 8-hour pay. I'm not allowed to work holidays. I'm not allowed to work overtime. I'm not allowed to work any other special pay. So my pay got cut quite a bit. And that would add more stress, right? So... because now I'm not making what I used to make, and I got to make ends meet either way. So needless to say that the relationship ended and I was on my own, and I swore to myself I was not going to get involved again. And I was living the single life. I was going out with multiple women. I was drinking whenever I wanted, where I wanted. So the behaviors and the attitude did not change. It probably got worse. A couple of years later, I get involved with another woman. And we got married through the courts eventually. So that was my second marriage. She had two kids from a previous relationship. And they were older already. They were already grown up. The daughter had twins. And the relationship that the daughter was in goes down the shitter. So she comes back to mom. And of course, now mom is with me. So that means they're in my house. So now I'm like an instant grandpa. And I was trying to do the best I could. My son is with his mom, who lived in San Marcos. On my visitations, I would have to drive. It was about a 3.5-hour drive from Laredo to Austin, and pick up my son and spend time with him. And then spend time with my new grandkids. But the affairs continued, and the drinking continued. And eventually, I find out that she, my wife, my second wife, was having an affair. And of course, you know, I got all offended. I'm like, well, how dare you? Even though I was doing the same damn thing, right? So in the process of finding out all this crap, there was another domestic violence arrest. This time, after, I don't know, after about, even though I didn't get convicted, I got arrested. But then the Border Patrol was like, dude, never once did they say, can we help you with anything? They just looked at the paper and they're like, you know what, dude? As of this day, you're no longer a Border Patrol agent. We're going to go and pick up all the rest of the government issued equipment that you have at your house, and you are removed. Your arrest authority has been removed, and you're no longer an agent. And goodbye. So I get fired.
I mean, I get what they have to do. You know, they have to do their own thing on the Border Patrol side. But I also, and I know for other issues that they don't reach out for mental health either. So Jorge's going through domestic issues, drinking, unhealthy behavior, and then now financially, because we all know, especially officers, that we are letting you work, but now you're going to work on day shift, no available overtime, no available off duty or anything to that effect. And you're trying to raise a family and you're not making the most amount of money. So you have that added stress onto it. So why aren't we as a culture going, yeah, I understand we have to get disciplined, and I understand Jorge had to get disciplined, but where was the resources there? In our last podcast, we were talking about these things, and it's all checkmark red flags, right, Brad?
Oh yeah. He's just rolling through them right now. All the check marks and all the red flags are just flying loud in this. And I, as much as I appreciate Jorge, what you're saying here about the department or your agency, I suspect that probably wasn't on your radar of, hey, I need some help, or I need some type of assistance in digging myself out of this. The point we were making on the last podcast was how stoicism gets in the way, machismo, manhood, of I can do this, I'll figure it out, I just got to drink some more. Is that fair?
Yep, I'm the Iceman. All right.
You're the Iceman.
Light
a stogie and hand me a drink.
Yep. So, of course, my union rep was like, dude, they shouldn't have fired you. We can fight this, whatever, whatever. The process of having an arbitrator listen to the case and then make a decision, which at the time was taking about a year and a half. So I took enough money out of my retirement so that I can live that year and a half. And of course, I went to go look for work, but not even Walmart would call me, dude. I'm like, come on now. So you got a middle-aged dude with no job, with, at the time, what seemed to be a crap load of money in my pocket. My mental health started spiraling downward, as my entire life, to be honest. I started drinking more. So some people were like, well, you know, Iceman, I mean, why didn't you recognize that you had a problem and dealt with it at that point when you got fired? Because like the good drunk that I was, it wasn't my fault. I got fired for no reason. You know, I shouldn't have gotten fired.
Yeah, it can't be me. Yep. It's got to be something else. It can't be my fault. I'm a victim to this whole thing. I'm just doing my thing.
So, now mind you, I wasn't a total screw up at work. I mean, I was a highly functional alcoholic. I happened to make some good arrests and took down, when I was a caniner, I took down thousands of pounds of drugs going through our checkpoints and all that good stuff. So there were some good things that I did, and obviously there were some bad things that I did. So that's why I was like, well, it can't be me, you know. I would remember all the good things and never the bad things. So eventually the arbitrator gets a hold of my case, and we have our day with the arbitrator, and this arbitrator sides with me. And I get my job back with back pay, and ask me if I paid back my retirement loan with my back pay. Of course not. Well, hey, what do you think I did?
Payday.
Bought a bus
of booze.
But I was being smart. So now I was, since my drinking increased more, I was buying the whiskey by the case. So I didn't have to go to the liquor store every day, and I was saving gas. So that was my chain of thought there.
That's wisdom, yeah. Right there.
Yeah.
That is very good wisdom. And you always had it available.
Yeah.
Because it made life better.
As a matter of fact, the last house that I owned in Laredo, the very first thing I looked for, it wasn't stores, it wasn't grocery stores, it wasn't gas stations, it was liquor stores. And there was one right across the street, and I'm like, oh, I like this house. But you haven't seen the house, sir. No, I like it already. So
it's the right spot.
That's how crazy shit got. So a lot of people would tell me now, it was like, well, fuck, that would have been the perfect time to quit drinking. You got your job back, you know, your name got cleared. You're back in uniform, get your shit together. And in my mind, I couldn't have been more put together any better than what I was, right? I was pretty much walking on water at that point in my delusion. So I swore again not to get involved with anybody else. And about 4 years later, I get married a third time.
Good on you, Jorge. I can barely find one that can stand me.
He's racking them up.
Yeah, dang, Jorge. Putting up with your ass? God bless him.
I'm an overachiever, man. What can I say?
You are definitely an overachiever.
So, here we are. Now, this one had 4 kids from a previous relationship. And for about a year and a half, 3 of them lived with me. And then eventually the older one went off to college. And there were the 2 teenage boys. But the first thing right off the bat was our parenting, I guess, skills were way different. She didn't believe in her boys cutting grass or washing cars or clean the pool or none of that. And it got to the point where I just said, screw it. You know, I don't need their help. But the resentment was there. The anger was there. And right off the bat, I'm not going to say this time I did not have an affair, but there were some issues. There were some trust issues on both parts, and things were just not working out. We had some heated arguments where one of us would leave from the house because it got pretty bad. But that third marriage came to an end. And then this time I'm like positive I'm not getting involved again. And so far I've been keeping my word. But now the drinking is completely out of control. Now I'm drinking about a half a gallon of whiskey a day. And this goes on for years, actually. I was overweight. I was diabetic. I was had heart issues. And I had a stack of, I had a whole bunch of pills that the doctor had put me on. And I had labeled some with a D that I take during the daytime, and I put an N on the ones I took at night. One of those medications was trazodone to help me sleep because I couldn't sleep. If I didn't drink myself to sleep, I wouldn't sleep. Before I go there, so depression also now has a very strong hold on me. Now I'm older. I really didn't want to be alone. But then looking back, I didn't want to live the way I was living either. If I wasn't working and if I wasn't drinking, I was passed out. And suicidal thoughts started creeping in. I wasn't happy with my life, even though I was still, at this point now, I was in the Riverine unit or the Marine unit. We patrol the border on a 18-foot airboat on the river that separates Mexico from Texas. And I was in the riverine unit for almost 13 years. And life was great, right? But no, not really. Life wasn't great because these suicidal thoughts started happening more often. I started thinking of different scenarios that I would put myself in. Laredo now is the biggest land port in the U.S. There's 18-wheelers everywhere. So that was my first thought. It's like, you know what? I'll just go head on with an 18-wheeler on the highway. And I'm for sure going to get creamed there. But then I was like, well, you know, what if I injure the driver or kill the driver? And he's got no business in this shit. You know, this is all my fault. Then I thought about the train. But I'm like, well, you know, I don't know what the train schedule is, and to just sit there and wait for a damn train to come so I can cross the trucks. So this went on and on, and of course, the drinking continued. And one day, I was off, so I woke up at like a 9-ish, 10-ish in the morning. I had 2 cups of coffee, and following the coffee, I poured myself. I would drink, you know, this jetty cup size full of whiskey, and I even got fancy and I bought those round ice molds so you can make ice out of balls of ice, I guess. So it would look fancy in my cup, right? And by the time it got nighttime, I was already drunk. I took all the medication that had the end for the night, which included the trazodone. And the doctor, when he prescribed me the medication to go to sleep, he was very adamant about not drinking alcohol with that medication. So I wake up in the middle of the night thinking that armed men are in my house and they're demanding money. They pull me out of my bed. They take me to the living room and I'm like, dude, you know, I got a couple $100 in cash. Let me give you that. Let me go to the room, get you that. And then we can work out the rest. There were three men. Two had rifles, one had a pistol. So they let me go into my room. So I'm thinking, fuck, dude, we're going to get into a hell of a gunfight. So I grab my gun, and I even put an extra magazine in my underwear because it was going to be a fucking shootout, right? So in my mind, this is happening. So I come back out of my bedroom, tactically clearing my living room, cutting the pie. And they're not in the living room. So I'm like, oh, fuck, they're ransacking the house. So I cleared the rest of my house, and I couldn't find anybody. And I'm like, oh, fuck, they must have gotten scared and left. So I run to the front door to see if I can see a vehicle. I didn't see crap. I immediately grab my cell, and I call 911. That's what a reasonable person would do. I tell the 911 operator I'm an off-duty agent. Armed men were in my house demanding money, and they left. So, of course, Laredo Police Department shows up in force, you know, supporting one of their own. By now, I had put a robe on. I opened the door and they're like, where's your weapon? I said, it's right there on the table. You know, as soon as I saw them, I cleared my weapon. I put the extra magazine and the pistol on the table by the front door. They came in, whatever, and I started telling them what happened. And one of the officers notices that I have cameras. He goes, hey, dude, let's look at your camera feed so we can get a better description and see maybe we can catch a vehicle. Okay. So we start reviewing the recording and nobody was ever in my house. And I'm like, well hold on, they were here. And one of the detectives that showed up, he goes, dude, have you taken any medication that might have messed with your head? I'm like, you know, in my mind, at the time, I didn't know or I didn't remember the doctor telling me about the trazodone causing hallucinations or whatever. And being multiplied, even worse if you take it with alcohol. So I didn't know what to answer. I just said no. But it was proven that nobody ever went to my house. Nobody was there. You see me tactically clearing my house in my underwear, which was a whole different, a whole sight you don't want to imagine. No. And one, and actually, you know, I called the detective later to thank him, but he goes, dude, you know what? As an agent, are you, you have union representation? I would call him right now. And that was exactly what I did. One of the reps went to my house immediately. And he's like, dude, just shut up. Don't say anything anymore. About 30 minutes later, a member of management from my station showed up. And they're like, dude, you know, what's going on? You know, I explained what happened. But just briefly, because the union was like, dude, you don't have to say anything. Just don't say nothing. And just keep quiet. So long story short, the DA in Laredo decided to file charges against me for filing a false police report, which it was bullshit, but it is what it is, right? So now I'm on admin duty again. The drinking has continued even more so now. Now my depression, my PTSD, my everything was 100%. I would drink until I would pass out or blackout. But I started waking up with my gun next to me more often.
Tell us what you feel like when, or what went through your brain when you woke up soberish and your gun next to you. What were your thoughts?
I would try to remember if I did anything with it, if I had put it up to my head, if, you know, if I wreck around into the chamber, you know, but of course I couldn't. It was kind of like my memory had a on off switch and somebody would just come and flip it off. And that I would remember up to a certain point and then nothing until I woke up again. And for the life of me, I would try to remember things and I couldn't. There were times where I would get called from buddies. I was like, hey, dude, just making sure you got home okay. I'm like, home? Where the fuck did I go? Where was I? Oh, you don't remember? You came to so-and-so bar last night, and you were already pretty lit when you got here. And we wanted to take you home, but you didn't want nobody to drive, and you left.
And isn't it funny how our brain just shuts off when it doesn't want to deal with that? Doesn't want to deal with the drama. It doesn't want to bring up the things that are dark within us. And it's got that power to do that for us. That's just mind boggling to me.
And also the fact that, I mean, the amount of alcohol that I was drinking, and obviously your body was like, oh, dude, We can't process this amount of alcohol and without affecting something. So, yeah. So let me go back a couple of years. I forgot to mention that I had a motorcycle. And I'm so grateful and I praise God every day that I wake up that I drove that motorcycle drunk more times than you would like to think. And I always got home. And then the one morning I was going to work and I was sober. Well, I might have had some liquor still in me, but one morning I was going to work, 7 a.m, and a young lady that was driving and putting makeup on didn't see my fat ass and ran me over. I sustained some pretty serious injuries. I broke both legs, my right in two places. I crushed my right foot. I broke both arms, my left in three places. I broke 13 ribs, both shoulder blades. And I didn't have a helmet on, so I had head trauma. I got airlifted to San Antonio, and the doctors started working on my foot before they worked on my head. But by the grace of God, again, after my foot surgery, the bleeding in my brain stopped without any surgical procedure. And they waited to see if the pressure in my skull would stop or would continue. And it stopped, so they didn't have to drill a hole in my skull to relieve the pressure. So that was brush number three with death. And my second ex-wife is a nurse, or was a nurse at the time. I don't know what she's doing now, but I would think she still is. And I had not removed her from my emergency contacts. So they reached out to her after the accident. And even though all the drama or whatever that we went through, she would still go by my house and make sure I was okay and change my bandages and all this stuff. And help me take a shower, because, oh my God, dude. You take for granted a lot of things, like the use of your hands. And when you can't use them, even simple tasks are extremely difficult to do. So now we fast forward back to where we were at. My third arrest, I'm not stupid, right? I may look it, but I'm not. And automatically, the first thing I think is, well, fuck. If they already fired me once, for sure I'm getting fired again. And now I still got some time to go to be even eligible to retire. And the admin duty, less pay bullshit was back on. I'm trying, you know, I'm talking to different people in my agency, you know, union reps and so forth. I'm like, dude, how many people have been on admin duty 3 times and go through it? And they're like, well, you're the only one, dude. Normally, once you get fired, that's it. You know, they stay fired. And but the DA, again, dismissed charges because it was a bullshit charge. In order to make the filing a false police report thing stick, they need to show that I had bad intentions and stuff, and obviously I didn't. But my mind doesn't take a break, right? The suicidal thoughts get worse. I'm thinking of drowning myself in the pool. I'm thinking of sitting in the tub and just eating my gun But then I'm thinking, well, you know, my poor sisters are going to have to come and scrub my brain matter off the tile, and it's going to get in the grout, and it's going to be impossible to fucking take out, and they're not going to be able to sell a house, and you know, so this is the mindset that I have now on the regular, on a daily basis. It's how to kill myself while I drink nonstop, pretty much. And I would black out and wake up and start drinking again, regardless of the time of day. Until one morning when I thought I lost all hope, and I thought the worst was to come. And in my mind, I had put myself as an agent. I could not see myself doing anything else. I'm a fucking agent. If I can't be an agent, then why the fuck am I here, right? So one morning, I do remember grabbing my gun, but I was so drunk already that either I couldn't hold it right, or I hesitated at the last split second. And when I pulled the trigger, the bullet went straight up into my ceiling. But the sound, I mean, I've been around, at this point now in my life, I've been around guns for the majority of my adult life. I've been to combat. I have heard bombs and grenades and tanks and whatever going off. But never had I had a pistol go off right next to my ear. I had some powder marks on the side of my head, but that was it. But that sound sobered me up really quick. And it was about 3 a.m. So I waited till about 7. And by now, I had taken a cold shower to try to sober up a little bit more. And I called one of my bosses, the number 2 in command there in my station, who was also a very good friend of mine. We pretty much had about the same amount of time in the patrol. And this is how my God has never abandoned me and taken care of my crazy ass all this time. So my boss is from Minnesota. And the year before, he lost his dad, who was a retired, I think, Minneapolis police sergeant. So he would make trips to Minnesota or to Minneapolis to visit his mom. And in one of those trips, he runs into a good friend of his from his cop days in Minneapolis, John Corcoran. And John goes and tells him, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I had to go to treatment because my life was fucking crazy, whatever, whatever. So this was months before my call to him. So I called him and like, boss, I need help, dude. And he's like, all right.
Now you told John, or you called your boss?
I called my boss.
Okay.
So my boss, not knowing what to do, but remembering that he had this conversation with his buddy, he called John. Hey, John, I got an agent dude. He's a good friend. He's a pretty good agent, you know. He's not a total dipshit. But he's asking for help, and I don't know how to help him. Well, fuck. I know some people at this place called Chateau. John called Austin. My boss said, hey, I want you in my office at whatever time, at 9 or whatever. So I go to my boss's office at whatever time he told me to be there. And a few minutes later, the phone rings, and it's John. And he goes, hey, here's a number to this guy. Call him. He's expecting your call. His name is Austin. He hangs up with John, calls Austin. Austin asked me a few questions. And I get a call later that day from Austin and says, when can you get here? So 4 days later, I was on a plane to Salt Lake City.
I just want to jump in there real quick. Can we give props to John for being vulnerable to his friend? Because if he was not vulnerable at that moment, you would have never gotten help. So my hat's off to you, John.
Big shout out to Cork.
Yeah, fucking Cork. I mean, who goes around and says, hey, fuck, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I went to treatment. You know what I mean? So I don't know how that conversation came about. But to me, my God was, obviously, he knew this was going to happen. And I go to Chateau, and the first day I'm there, it's like, oh, yeah, we got to do yoga. I'm like, what? I'm like, fucking Marines and fucking yoga, dude. And Danny was like, oh, yeah, I'll even make you wear yoga pants. I'm like, oh, hell no, that ain't going to happen. So for the record, I never wore yoga pants.
There's nothing to deny it.
So I was, I don't think we've said this yet, but Chateau, Jorge and I were at Chateau overlapping. So we were there at a similar time. And I can testify that I never saw him in yoga pants. Now, I saw him without pants on a couple of times, but I never saw him in yoga pants. So, and Jorge, I do want to actually honor your time as well as ours. So we talk a lot about Chateau. So I'm going to push us on a little bit to after Chateau. Your time, and I don't want to ignore how important Chateau your experience was, but I want to spend some time talking about how you are now. So Chateau had a deep and indelible impression on your life, and it changed your life.
It saved my life.
Arguably saved your life. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Yes, thank you. Saved your life. And you were brave and courageous enough to say, hey, I'm going to go up here and I'm going to do hard work. What does Chateau do to Jorge's life? What does Jorge's life look like since Chateau?
Man, Brad, I was able to go see my son graduate from the University of Texas sober. One of the biggest, I guess, other than trying to eat my gun, but not remembering a lot of things for decades. It wasn't just a few here and there. It was decades long that I don't remember crap. So being able to see my son walking through the stage to receive his diploma, it was amazing. Needless to say, I didn't get fired. Eventually, so the culture in my agency with the Border Patrol, with CBP in general, it started changing. Now mental health is talked about a lot more. Programs like Chateau are on our websites, you know, at work. When you open your computer up and you get all your agency homepage or whatever. And it's a different agency than when I went in. So one of the things that I was able to do at the time, the chief of the Border Patrol was really interested in the resiliency program. And they came up with a program, and they asked for volunteers to be instructors. And I don't know why, but I was like, you know what? That's exactly what I need to try to help others. And I signed up and I became an instructor and I started giving my classes. So obviously, speaking about resiliency and how can incorporate my journey into the classes became huge. And I started doing that. And sure enough, after my classes, agents would come up to me, or even other government employees, not necessarily agents, but they're like, hey, dude, you know what, Iceman, I may have a drinking problem, dude. How can you help me? And that totally changed me. It to be in recovery and be able to help somebody is one of the most amazing feelings, I guess, you can have or I can have. About a year and 4 months after Chateau, I was involved in a high-speed chase at work, and this idiot, our trooper, our DPS troopers, spiked the car, so he lost the two tires on the passenger side, and he was doing about 90 miles an hour on rims at a point, right? And the vehicle comes to a halt in high grass, and the driver takes off running. And now at this time, I'm a little older, I'm a little slower. So I let the young agents chase the fucking driver, right? Me and the sergeant with DPS, we stay back. And I said, hey, dude, let's go clear the vehicle. So we go clear the vehicle. But by now, because the rims were red hot from driving without tires, and he, like I said, he parked in a grassy area, the vehicle was on fire. So the whole passenger area of the vehicle was full of smoke. It was hard to see anything. But in my mind, the vehicle had gone through our checkpoint and the dog alerted on the vehicle, or canine alerted to the vehicle. And he was sent to secondary and he fled from that point. And that's where I started the chase. But then, you know, we put it on the radio and DPS was in the area. And like I said, they set up spike strips and they spiked them. Eventually he lost the tires. And so we get to this area. So now the vehicle's engulfed. The driver is caught a couple hundred yards away. He's handcuffed, and as they're bringing him back, he tells the agent that has him that there's somebody in the back of the vehicle. So through the radio, he messages or he tells us, hey, dude, the driver's claiming somebody's in the back of the vehicle. The vehicle, the front of the vehicle is completely engulfed in flames. So me and the sergeant run back to the vehicle. We break the window, and I knew as soon as we break the window, oxygen's going to go in and flames are going to just, like, you know, like you see in the movies, right? Pretty much. I'm not a firefighter, so I don't know how that should work. But I know you need air for fire to exist. So he breaks the window. All the smoke comes flying out. We're trying to get the door open of the SUV. It was, I believe it was an Escalade. Anyway, we're trying to get the back door open. We couldn't open it. And Sergeant Hernandez starts throwing out towels and sheets and all kinds of crap. And he goes, there's nobody back there. But I knew the canine had hit. So I go back. I cinch the hairs on my hands a little bit. And I'm reaching in. I'm trying to look through the smoke. And I see what looks like a duffel bag. And I'm thinking, well, if the dog hit, there's got to be drugs in the duffel bag. So I grabbed the duffel bag to pull it out, and it was heavy as fuck. So I'm like, oh shit. And I'm trying to get a different hold on the bag, and I'm guessing I grabbed her elbow. But there was a young lady stuffed in a duffel bag in the back of that burning SUV, and I'm trying to pull her out, and it was too heavy for me to lift. So the sergeant comes back, I tell him, there's somebody in the duffel bag. And we pull her out, and obviously we saved her life. But after the adrenaline dropped down a little bit, the first thing I thought was, there's no fucking way in hell I would have been doing this if I wasn't sober.
That's awesome. I love that for you. So I know retirement is something you're really proud of. Recently retired, honorably retired. I saw some of the pictures. I got to see some of the pictures of you being honored in your retirement, of having a career with the Border Patrol. And I think it is a loud testament to the hard work you did at Chateau, and even harder work since, because I know I can always call Jorge and say, how are you doing? And your response is,
I am blessed and unstoppable.
Isn't that amazing?
And Jorge, in his retirement and in his journey, will help anyone. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He gives out his phone number to anybody that is in need of help or wants help and is genuine about it. And I believe that has a lot to do with what John did and the people around him in that peer support community. And Jorge's talked people off ledges, and he's just been an amazing and humble human being.
And Jorge, as we kind of wrap up here, I want to give you just a few seconds to, any message to anybody out there hurting or feels like they're alone in their journey of being out of balance and hurting, and I want to give you that opportunity, because I you have such a powerful message, such a powerful story. So if you were to tell folks out there who may be in a similar spot that you're in, what would you share with them?
You know, I tell everybody that would listen, one, you're never alone. And two, you always have hope. When you start thinking about suicide, about you being not worthy, it's really not you. It's whatever is altering your mind, whether it's alcohol or pills or drugs. It's not your own mind. And one thing, and I know some folks are not partial to religion, but for me, in my recovery, it's extremely important, and one of the reasons why I'm still sober today. But I just recently, and I mentioned it at the reunion there at Chateau a couple of weeks ago. So one of the things that I started doing, instead of, now that I'm retired and I'm home a lot more than what I was used to, when I was isolated and drinking myself to death, when I got out of Chateau, that was a worry, right? That was like, what am I going to do now? So I started making rosaries. As a matter of fact, I believe you two individuals, I made some for you.
They are gorgeous.
Brad still has his. So
I still have mine, but it's in my bedroom.
Because I'm older, right? I forget something. So I would write down people's names and what color they would prefer it or whatever. And I had never counted until a few months ago. And guess that, guess how many I've made?
Oh, I can't even imagine.
I'm over 700 made.
And these things are handcrafted, individual, one by one, individualized to the person. So, and they are absolutely gorgeous. So he puts his time, effort, his own money into these things and out of the goodness of his heart.
Yeah. So several people have already told me, like, hey, dude, why don't you sell them? Because, I mean, honestly, beats ain't cheap, right? Nothing's cheap in this world. But I did it to keep me busy and to make something good out of my situation, right? So I refuse to sell them now because I'll be cheating myself out of why I even started doing them. So, but now, I mean, now I'll say, okay, I'll take donations if you want to give a donation.
Oh, I think that is very adequate and apropos to receive donations because this is out of pocket. But I do appreciate the standpoint of doing it for not receiving money because that lends to your recovery.
Yeah, it's as much as I hope that, you know, I make them to people who, well, obviously who ask for one, and just for people who have touched me one way or another, even if they're not Catholic, because the rosary, the praying of the rosary is the Catholic thing. But even, you know, obviously, Brad, you know, you keep yours handy, and I just, when I make them, I take them to my priest so they can get blessed. I'll never send out a rosary that's not blessed. And the blessing that I put into it is that maybe somehow, some way, it touches you and it brings you some type of peace within you. So whether you pray it or not, that's my blessing that I put out.
Well, Jorge, I cannot thank you enough for coming on and telling your story. What an amazing story. Rob, any final thoughts as we kind of wrap up?
Just how incredible Jorge is, just his person, his outlook on life. And I didn't know Jorge before recovery. It sounds like he was a different person, but this man will give you the shirt off his back and then answer your phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning just to help you. So he's a true hero. I mean, been overseas, been there, done that, then came and protected the motherland here. And now he's helping people in recovery and still helping first responders with his class. that he puts on, and he'll put it on for anybody that wants to listen. And God bless this man. This man is incredible.
Well, a couple of final thoughts. One is that big old fat cigar, he's almost gone all the way through it in the entire time that we've sitting here, had this conversation. But one thing you said early on, Jorge, is your mom always told you you had a purpose. I think you found it.
I think
you found it.
I honestly think I did. As a matter of fact, I called yesterday to the local community college to inquire about becoming a substance abuse counselor.
Oh, that's awesome.
So,
and that's fitting.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Jorge, we wish you the best on your recovery. We wish you the best on all the help you're doing for our, obviously, your agents to be all first responders out there. You're making a difference, my friend. I love you. We'll see you soon.
I love you guys too.
Love you, Jorge. You're awesome.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.